Everybody, and welcome to the seventh seminar this year in the series co-sponsored by the Education Employers Task Force and Centre for Education and Industry at the University of Warwick. Somebody almost once said that the point of an academic career was not just to understand the world, but to change it. Our speaker today is Professor Alison Wolfe from King's College London, who's probably amongst the very most influential academic voices in this country in influencing the direction of policy. Her subject today will be school-to-work transitions in a liberal economy. Thank you, Alison.
Thank you very much. I have to say, it feels more like beating one's head against a brick wall than having influenced most of my interaction with government. But so I guess that's just, this is one of these relative, not absolute statements, but thank you. Yes, I am indeed going to talk about school-to-work transitions. I should start by saying that what I mostly want to do in the next 20 minutes is really just lay out the world in which we live. I don't have any magic solutions. I'm not sure that anybody has any magic solutions. If they did, they would have swept around the world, the girdle around the world in 90-minute style. But there are a number of things which I think it helps to realise are common to most industrialized countries, pose common challenges to everybody, and mean that it's not that a given country is likely to be way out on a limb. These are very real changes and developments that go across the developed world. But it's also, I think, worth remembering that the age at which people make this school-to-work transition has changed really quite dramatically, actually in the lifetime of most people in this room, actually, not just those of us who have sort of stopped counting. In the 1960s, it was absolutely normal for people to leave school at 15, not bother to pick up any formal qualifications, go straight into jobs. That was normality. To wait until you were 17 or 18 was already a minority. To go into higher education was a tiny minority. And really large numbers of people doing full-time institution-based study in anything except a small number of higher education institutions was really very rare. And that was, again, an international pattern. America had mass higher education earlier than most people, but really it was normal to basically leave school at an age where we essentially treat people as children. And actually, a friend of mine the other day in the US showed me this extraordinary photograph. It was of a young couple on their wedding day, and they looked, to modern eyes, about 25. They were actually Appalachian, and he was dressed in a sort of stiff wool suit. She was dressed in her best, and this was their wedding day. And as I said, to modern eyes, they looked about 25. And they were, in fact, 14 and 15. And that is only just over 100 years ago. And they stayed married, by the way, and they had a large family, and you know, I can tell you the backstory of the photograph if you want. But what I want to bring home is not that they were right and we were wrong, but that we have prolonged youth in a way that no other society has been able to afford to, or would have thought that it was, you know, halfway sane to. And therefore, when we talk about school-to-work transitions, we're talking about a world in which education is highly prolonged, and in which the transition into work is also, it's also seen as problematic in a way it was not before. You went and you got a job, and you might get sacked. You know, another personal anecdote, I was at my uncle's funeral a couple of weeks ago, and his son was just talking about, you know, his early work experience and how this was in the days before current labour legislation, and, you know, how his early experience was he got a job and then he would be sacked. Got a job and then he would be sacked. So it's not that everybody went into lifetime employment, that's another myth. But it was not seen as a sort of a problematic thing in which young people found it very hard to get real jobs. They didn't find it any harder to get real jobs than anybody else. They just might get sacked from them, like everybody else. So we do, I think, live in a new world. And we also live in a particular sort of economic environment. And you know, I said school-to-work transitions in a liberal economy, not because I want to get into caught up, please, in discussions of liberal versus neoliberal and what it means. But because, again, I think it's important to understand that some of the problems that we face and some of the experiences that we have are very closely related to the sort of economy and the sort of legal framework under which, in the modern world, we live. And if you had a planned economy, or an economy in which basically people were owned by their lords, again, there wasn't any problem about school-to-work transition. There might be a lot of what we call concealed unemployment, in the sense that people had jobs where they weren't producing anything very much, and you could have a very large amount of exploitation because, you know, going right back to when people were serfs, there was no problem keeping them employed, they just didn't get to keep much of what they produced. But we live in a very particular sort of economy. And it's an economy which is marked, and which we've signed up to. It's marked by basically free trade. I mean, I know that not everything is traded freely, but by world historic standards, it's a world of free trade, which has profound impact on particular industries, particular companies, and on a government's ability to do anything about it. It's a world of free movement of labour in some regions. Actually, compared to the 19th century, it's not a world of free movement. But in some regions, and that for anybody in the UK includes very markedly, of course, the EU, you've got free movement of labour. But you've also got that combined with very heavy restrictions in a global context, so that the sort of mass emigration that was welcomed in the 19th century by countries, where actually you just went if you could raise the steamer fare, you went. That no longer exists. We don't have directed labour. You find your own job. You're not told where to go. And this is something which is so obvious that it sort of seems hardly worth noting, but actually it's quite important. We have minimal industrial policy. And then there are two other things that I think it's also really important to be aware of if you're concerned with policy, working with today's teenagers and people in their early 20s. Particularly between sort of 1945 and you know, in Europe this was incredibly obvious. I mean, in France they talk about les 30 glorieuses, the 30 wonderful years. But it's also true to a lesser degree, but less dramatically, but sort of true for this country for decades. Basically, there was a huge shift in the nature of the labour market. It was easy to have social mobility because lots of jobs were opening up at the top. So, again, in most people's families, if you think about it, the general trend will have been for people to have better jobs than their parents, better jobs than their grandparents, not always on an individual basis, but generation on generation, there would be more of you who had what was seen as nice and desirable jobs. And what has happened in the last 10 to 15 years, and there's a big debate raging in the literature, which Marshall knows very well as well, about whether this is permanent or temporary and there can be another great leap forward, is that this fast growth in class one and class two occupations has slowed down. And you're not getting this big growth in the number of openings at the upper end of the job pyramid. And at the same time, you're getting a decrease in the number of skilled manual jobs. And again, this is actually for very profound economic reasons, because one of the reasons you're getting that decline is because a lot of the jobs in which people used to have skilled manual occupations are just way more productive. You can just produce a certain amount of stuff with a very small number of people. And, you know, it's certainly arguable that manufacturing is going the way that agriculture went before it. So in agriculture, we now produce amounts which would have been inconceivable to our agrarian ancestors, with minute proportions of the workforce. And this, much the same is happening in a large number of respects in manufacturing. So whether or not one revives one's manufacturing industry, there is, short of cataclysm, not going to be these large, you know, really major groups of high-skilled manual jobs that once existed. And, you know, people refer to the hourglass economy. So what you've also got, and this sort of goes to a considerable extent with the economics, but also with the aspirations, is you've got increased average length of education in most countries. And I think there are two things driving this. First of all, there's no question that the change in the job market exerts a pull. because there are lots of nice jobs, not enough for everybody who might want them, but there are, by historic standards, a lot of class one and class two jobs. Lots of us can have jobs which in past eras only a very tiny minority could have, where we get to not be completely worn out by physical labour and basically do jobs which to some degree use our minds and generally are seen. So there are lots of them, and this exerts a pull. It means that lots of people are being educated to do those jobs, and lots of people aspire to them for their children and for themselves. So this basically pulls people, means that there's a real demand, but it also means that there's a real push through, and I'll come back to that in a minute, because essentially that's one of the things that creates a lot of education, not necessarily that you're fitting the two together, but that everybody's in a world in which they're aware that education is a route through to the to not just to the very top, but higher up. And you also get a rapid rise in higher education numbers, and again, this is as much, in my view, about governments responding to the aspirations and desires of their citizens as it is about any need in the economy for as many higher education graduates as we have. So sometimes governments will expand higher education because they believe, because of returns to education, that this is good for growth. But I think one of the reasons that you get this rapid growth in higher education all over the world is that governments are responding more or less directly to the perceived demand of their population, of their voters, and to the aspirations that they have for themselves and their children. Going with that, and again, this is something where we are an outlier, delayed specialisation is the rule. The degree of specialisation which exists in the English education system has been extraordinary for decades. You know, we actually, until the late 1940s, we were like everybody else. We had school cert, and it was grouped award, and we were no different. And in the late 40s, we set off on this early specialisation route, and we don't ever seem to have been able to get back off it. So basically, the world pattern is delayed specialisation. The world pattern is also high returns to formal qualifications, or rather high returns to some formal qualifications. And again, that's it's not just an English pattern, it's not just a British pattern, it's a worldwide pattern. It's just that most countries are fortunate enough not to have as many qualifications as we have. And then the final thing, which I think, again, is sort of the context in which one faces both general issues about transition and one's own national ones, is that there are wide variations in the status and nature of apprenticeship. Some countries have apprenticeship systems that work very well indeed. Only a few, but they exist, and they are mostly in mainland Europe. And those do exist. Almost nowhere has a full-time school-based vocational pathway which enjoys status and respect. And I want to lodge that because I think it's very important. Again, that's not just us. It is an international phenomenon. Apprenticeship can be seen as highly respected and worthwhile, at least up to the age of 18. I mean, post-18, vocational gets a sort of, becomes much wider, you know. It obviously includes not just, becoming a cameraman, becoming a nurse, becoming a doctor, but up to 18, full-time vocational pathways, which exist again in most countries, including to a degree some of those that have apprenticeships, they do not anywhere enjoy the sort of status that apprenticeship has or that academic programs have. So just quickly, just to give you some feeling of the scale, and I'm sorry, this is basically because I just haven't had the energy to try and make sense and to work out what to do with the German figures. It stops in 96 because up until then I was basically, it was before you, using just post-unification ones. But anyway, basically just to give you an idea about a century's growth, essentially the blue is the university enrollments in France, Germany and UK, the three big European countries at the beginning of the century. Those tiny little blue things you can hardly see. Pink is the raw figures 96 years later, and green is adjusted for population growth. And I think that everything else that happens in the job market and in transitions for young people has to be seen against a background of this enormous growth in higher education and what it does to the rest of the labour market. sits there. It's not an elephant in the room because everybody knows it's there. So in that sense, it's but it's an enormously important fact because of the knock-on effect it has on young people's decisions, on the way that employers make decisions, and on what happens to the rest of the job market and the education market. The other thing I want to sort of make a note of, to point out, is that modern labour markets in developed countries, long developed countries that have been developed for a long time, are very often characterised by what's essentially a dual structure. And we have this less than many European countries, partly interesting enough because we have had a youth unemployment problem for less time, and had, for good and bad, a less corporatist economy. But European countries and Japan are marked by what are commonly known as dual labour markets. You've got a large inner core of people who have stable, permanent contracts, which often have good benefits associated with them. Very often, very strong security of tenure. They're protected quite rightly by labour laws from being sacked. High benefits, and then around them you have this penumbra of low status, low security, low pay, or not even necessarily low status, but low pay, low security, short-term jobs. That is particularly obvious in France, but it's also open in Japan. It's much less obvious in North America. North America also has far less protection, far less of an inner core. And then the next thing I want to just say is that in the UK we have a very specific thing, which is that we used to have a lot of apprenticeships, and we now have very few that would be recognised by our grandparents as apprenticeships. And that's something we can come to in discussion. But basically, a combination of circumstance and enthusiastic help from the government basically killed off apprenticeship in this country in the 1970s and 1980s. And I don't think we've got very far towards restoring it to health for young people. We have high levels of regional inequality. That's actually true for much of Europe, but it's a really important fact. We have general stability in our upper secondary academic routes and constant reform of upper secondary vocational, which means that employers don't have the faintest idea what's going on half the time and have given up trying to keep up. And again, that sort of relates to that great big, you know, we know what a university is, we know what A-levels are, we don't know what all this stuff is. And we also, which, you know, I think, again, one has to take account of, we also have had open accession for EU nationals as well as high levels of immigration. And I know this is a fraught subject, but I think it's something which at least in some areas, the fact that government employers have had a choice between hiring a local 18-year-old with a qualification they don't understand or a recent immigrant with a degree, and I think that further complicates things. I do. Okay, very quickly, I just want to explain why I think that sort of the growth of graduates is so important. I think the point is that employers have to make decisions. They have to make decisions they can defend not only to themselves but to their associates. And it's a little bit like buying a computer. Nobody gets sacked, or nobody used to get sacked, for buying IBM. If you're going to shortlist, and you've got people with qualifications which are seen as reputable, which show that they could stick it out for 3 years, and there are more and more of them, then it becomes easier and easier to use academic qualifications and degrees as a sifting mechanism. And so when you've got very few people who are graduates, then you know that, you know, most of the people you want to hire are non-graduates. When you've got quite a lot of graduates, you start to think, well, you know, I could basically make this graduate entry only, and that'll sort of get rid of most of the applicants, and then I can give attention to choosing the right ones from within them. And sometimes you wonder whether you will get there. It's the slight nightmare of getting there that was one of the things, I think, that persuaded the government, rightly or wrongly, to introduce fees. And there is a real problem for most countries about continuing pressure to expand higher education because more and more people want it. Okay, a couple more quick things. Youth unemployment, how bad is it and what is it? Now, one of the things that I want to underline is that most of the things I've described to you are long term. They are not about the current recession. Now, the current recession obviously matters, and we've all seen the headlines, and we all know that when economic times are bad, the young are always the first sufferers. And sure enough, and if I just looked at the OECD figures for other countries as well, if you look at the unemployment rate, which is the top one, you see that it's going up. And that's the proportion of people who are actually registered as looking for work and can't get it. But if you look at the unemployment rate as a proportion of the age group, which is the lower one, you will see that it actually hasn't moved very much. And that's because what has happened is that, if you like, discouraged workers, discouraged 16 and 17-year-olds who would quite possibly have just as soon have been in work, have, you know, are in education. So this is, I think, the key thing to take bear in mind. You know, the contrast between my Appalachian 15-year-olds, but also between, young Brits in the 1950s and 1960s. 16 and 17-year-olds are not in work. Essentially, there is almost no youth labour market left, and even those numbers will include people who are listed as... That will include apprentices, because they will be listed as employed. So you've got a complete fall-off. And you also, I think, one of the things that's also quite interesting is, again, in spite of the recession, if you take 18 to 24-year-olds, again, it's not as dramatic, but again, what you're getting is a secular downward turn. It's basically down. You know, it's not as dramatic. It's still up there as a large part of the age group, but it's going like that. And in most countries, most developed countries, the same is true. Couple of final quick points. The overall figures can see huge variations. And I just pulled out a few kind of randomly. Percentage of 16 to 24-year-olds claiming. South Oxfordshire 2.2, Sandwell 12.1, Derry 13. County Durham wasn't actually as bad as I thought, but in some bits it's dire. 8.2. Even within London, you are getting, in the London area, you're going from 3 in Camden, 3.1 in Reigate, 6.2 in Thurrock, 7.5 in Lewisham, 7.5 in Newham. You know, these are big, big variations. And I think, again, what it underlines is that for many of the people who are not going via the higher education route, when you go via higher education, you go into a national labour market. If you're not going via higher education, you are much more of a local labour market. And that's, I think, why, you know, the regional and the local issues matter so much. And the thing which I think is the biggest challenge for us, really the major challenge for us, is this noise around vocational awards that I've referred to. We've got lots of people going into higher education. Employers know what it's about. People aspire to it. 98% of parents of newborn babies want their children to go to go to university, and I think the other 2% were just miscoded. It's, you know, we've got poor returns to specific occupational awards, which used to be called NVQs and now suddenly aren't anymore. We've got middling returns to quasi-vocational. We've got very good returns to doing a proper apprenticeship. And when we look at all of these, we also have to be aware that most people do not stay in the occupational area they go into when they first leave school and get their first job. And that's true even for apprentices. We are not doing very well with apprenticeships for 16 and 17-year-olds. However, the government has been putting in huge effort. 16-year-olds are hard, 17-year-olds are not great, 18-year-olds marginally better. Level 3 apprenticeship starts for 16 to 18-year-olds, which are the red ones, are sort of not going anywhere very much. As I suspect almost everybody in this room knows, in the last couple of years, all the growth has been among adults. And we can argue for hours about whether they're apprenticeships, but the fact is they're not young, whatever they are. And that's equally true for what I call advanced apprenticeships, which is the sort of apprenticeship that a Danish or a German kid would do with lots of education, extra skills. So it seems to me that what we have to understand about the youth into work transition is that this is not something about the current recession. It's about some long-term trends in the economy and in education which create huge challenges. And create huge challenges, especially for a school-based, non-academic route. but which also underline, and again, you know, I'm not saying anything that is new, underline the critical importance of apprenticeship, because that's something which actually is recognised, which the labour market recognises, which actually is valued because, not just of the skills, but because in a sense it does the same as a degree. It says this kid can stick it out, can turn up for work, can stay with it, even if they're not going to be a baker, and the biggest employer of bakers in Germany is the BMW assembly line. But even if they don't stick with it, this is something which is worthwhile and worth having. And I think the other thing that I would like to address long term, without having any great optimism about, is do we really need to make everybody wait so long before they go out to work? We seem to feel that we should be judged by how many years we can keep young people in education. The more we can keep them in, the better. The French are the record holders for this, because they have the most messed up youth labour around. It seems to me that this is not in itself a good thing if all you're doing is basically recycling and recycling without moving sort of up the distribution. And that while I'm not in the least advocating that 14-year-olds should go into the mills, I do wonder whether our belief that keeping everybody in education till 21 would be an unmitigated good is really quite so obvious, and whether we shouldn't be thinking much more in terms of people going in and out when they actually want to be there. So without any solutions, that's where I will leave you. I think there are some very major challenges, and I think the major challenges are ones which involve, which cannot be solved by simply inventing another qualification. Thank you.